Good morning. For years, Hawaii has been warned of its physician shortage. So will telemedicine make it better? According to one doctor, it's already making it worse. Dr. Jim Barhol explains in our latest edition of The Last Job in Hawaii. And we find out more of what Dr. Hans von Tilburg found during yesterday's live dive to explore two World War II Japanese mini-submarines involved in the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Guitarist and luthier Kyle and Reese is also a historian who has uncovered rich and little-known chapters of Hawaii's musical history. Inspired by what he's learned, he's created a new hybrid instrument, and he'll share some of that history and perform some Christmas music on his new acts live in our studio.
It's Thursday, December 8th. Those conversations and a few more coming up on The Conversation after these headlines.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris. It
amazes me that there are still discoveries to be made under the surface of the ocean.
You know, I think that amazes a lot of people because when you just, you know, look out and you're looking at the ocean, the thought that there could be a great deal under there maybe might percolate. But yeah. When you actually see some of it, as we saw yesterday, it's quite amazing. Now, this week, Hawaii has been revisiting a history that abruptly veered into war with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And as part of the commemoration, submersibles have been exploring what's left of the ship sunk during the attack. And yesterday, of two Japanese mini-submarines that were part of it. One still has the bodies of its two crew members inside. NOAA maritime archaeologist and historian Hans von Tilburg was part of the exploration team. He joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
It was amazing to be watching that yesterday, although we couldn't see it, obviously, in real time. We got to see it a little bit later. But knowing that one of those subs was starting to decay and that parts of it were now, you know, broken compared to what you saw even 2 years ago, seemed to put a little bit more emphasis on why it's important for us to be able to capture what we know of the history that's lying beneath the ocean. Is that why you felt especially important it to be done now?
That's right. These are very historically important sites. They remind us of an event that changed the islands, certainly changed the Pacific, changed our country. And so we've been monitoring the status of the mini-subs over time, and like everything in the ocean, they reach a certain age and begin to deteriorate further where the subs actually open up and we can see more of the history inside.
They're small, so would you say that because of their size, the advancing age of all of its components would be more prone to aging more quickly?
Well, I think their size might even help them. I mean, originally they're just a tube of steel, and so that's fairly strong underwater, but they've been balanced on a high point beneath the midsection of the hull, meaning the bow and the stern are overhanging scours, and the weight eventually has broken the stern and bow off of the sub that was sunk by USS Ward on December 7th.
So that made it more prone to aging in that way?
Exactly.
Which is very different than what we've seen, say, with the Arizona and some of the submersibles that have gone into the below decks where there isn't a lot of oxygen, not a lot of growth, and it seems like it has just, you know, stopped in time, aside from being underwater.
Right, right. The processes of deterioration over time is site-dependent, environment-dependent. And in those cases where there's less oxygen and interior spaces, you get excellent preservation of historic artifacts. And you can peer back in time then, like looking through a window back 70, 75 years.
When you were around the sub with the bodies of the two young Japanese crew members inside of it, that must have been a very distinct feeling of not only being part of an exploration of history, but also being at a gravesite.
you're right. You know, reconciliation is an important lesson from World War II, and we're as respectful to these sites as we are to our own in Pearl Harbor and elsewhere. And so we actually have protocols in place for surveys like this in the Pacific, where if we encounter human remains, we don't broadcast images of those things live over the internet, although the rest, you know, we can share with the public.
So presumably from what you've just said, that means you saw some of those remains yesterday, but
no,
that was not broadcast?
No, we haven't seen any human remains in this sub, and it's not necessarily something we're pursuing that angle.
From this point forward, what happens with the subs that are there that you've been documenting? Will there be another foray down to be able to capture whatever has happened in the next couple of years?
Well, you know, as projects come and go, and as our work with University of Hawaii and the Undersea Research Lab and with the Office of Exploration and Research for NOAA focuses on various studies, we have over time monitored every couple of years, gone back to those sites. And now that the cylinder is beginning to be opened up and oxygen is introduced into the interior of the subs, there may be more history and even artifacts that can be preserved from those sites for a future.
So are you saying that potentially we might see some of these artifacts brought up and kept in a museum?
That's a possibility. As the subs deteriorate over time, there may be things we can save.
Would that also, or what does that mean for the bodies that would be there too?
Well, that would be a conversation we would have with the Japanese consulate and the Japanese government, and we'd be very reverential about, you know, any plans of possible recovery or leaving them in situ.
Because if you're talking about this thing potentially breaking up, what may happen once it starts to really break up? No one really
exactly
knows.
That's a concern, and that's a reason for monitoring these particular mini subs over time.
As you are going to be monitoring this, what's next on the horizon for you, as there is clearly so much more history under the surface?
Well, you know, these two subs are a very critical part of the events that started immense changes in the territory of Hawaii. But then there were years and years of intensive training and activity among the islands. All of the amphibious exercises and the aircraft overhead, the islands are actually surrounded by sites like this, and some of those are even war graves. So we're completing an inventory of what is known about all of those types of resources, not just for the history and the archaeology, but what that means for the marine environment and what it means to have large ships and aircraft and these types of sites deteriorate underwater.
From what you just said, can we infer that there's also, there could possibly be torpedoes still there too?
Unfortunately, it's part of our legacy that there is unexploded ordnance in the oceans, and it's a real concern for us to understand how that falls apart over time.
Do we know much about that, including what may be on one of the subs that you saw yesterday?
The sub that we viewed that was sunk by the USS Ward does have two torpedoes in the bow, and that's a concern for any proposal that would be impacting that site. We don't really know if those are live, you know. I mean, over time, theoretically, there's incursion of the seawater and they become inert, theoretically. But nonetheless, we're very careful with what we do on a site like that where there are munitions.
For people who hear that and think, wait a minute, you know, could we be out there and potentially be witness to something potentially exploding, I hear you say, well, we don't know what we don't know, but there's this theory that says it's not going to happen, and one of the reasons why we're mapping it more. We've seen what has happened with ordnance elsewhere. And is there truly a plan to be able to recover some of that, or just to simply monitor it, or what would you tell people about the ordnance that we know is unexploded?
Well, actually, there have been studies in the past, and some of them carried out by the University of Hawaii and Undersea Research Lab to understand the extent and distribution of unexploded ordnance south of this island of Oahu. And so in proposals for further marine science in this area, and in fact one I've been working on now, we include the concern of the ordnance and our ability to, if we're out there looking for other things, also note where we find things like that and add that to our understanding of how much is out there.
And what maybe could or could not be cleaned up. Thank you so much for coming in. Good to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Bethann.
Hans von Tilburg is a maritime archaeologist and historian with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. We posted a video of the dive from yesterday on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. And just a quick note, a tsunami watch has been issued for the state of Hawaii following an earthquake off the Solomon Islands with a preliminary magnitude of 8.0. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center issued the watch, which is the level below a warning, and it means that they're still investigating. The center says investigation is underway to determine if there's really a threat to Hawaii and if there's any impact. The estimated earliest arrival of the first wave would be this afternoon at 2:56. We'll keep you updated with the latest information as we receive it. And now we're going to hear some lovely sounds of a new stringed instrument hybrid. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the most influential slack key guitarists in history. His career lasted almost 50 years, beginning in the 1940s. Back then, slack key was mostly a back porch family affair heard at baby luau's and community gatherings, and he was one of the first artists to take his style to nightclub stages and recording studios. He was born on Oahu in 1932, started playing the guitar at age 12 when he was living with his grandfather, Harry Purdy, on Molokai. When he heard a recording of Hi'ilawe by Gabby Pahunui, his course in life was set. His own recording debut came as a sideman to the legendary Vicky E.E. Rodriguez on a record called Make'e Ailana, released in 1954. His own debut came 10 years later with Waimea a Cowboy, which earned him a gold record. In the 1970s, he shared his knowledge with younger performers like George Kuo, Ozzy Kotani, and Makana. This morning, we're looking for the name of the legendary Waimea a Cowboy, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get the prize.
Aloha, I'm Joanne Itano from the University of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
The musical history of Hawaii is filled with the sounds of stringed instruments, not only the slack key guitar and the ukulele, but the mandolin, banjo, and the fiddle. Guitarist and instrument builder Kylan Reese's research into that history and into the time when Hawaiian musicians were some of the most influential in the country has brought him some exciting discoveries and has inspired him to create a new hybrid instrument. Kylan's with us in our studio. Good morning, Kylan.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Bethann. So good to be here with you guys.
Your research has really been a reminder, not that you needed reminding, of what a rich culture Hawaii had in the late 19th, early 20th century, particularly as a musical culture, yeah?
It's been amazing. And having lived here about 15 years and been a musician here and also worked building and repairing instruments, I feel incredibly lucky to have been exposed to all that I have. And the historical research I'm doing now in collaboration with the Martin Guitar Company, whose history in the islands goes back to the 1850s officially, and 1886 as officially dealing in Martin instruments here through the Bergstrom Music Company. They really want these stories told, and the stories of some of these early Hawaiian musicians who were the rock stars of their day, traveling all over the world, teaching Hawaiian music and hula, and really crafting and designing the what was to become the most popular steel string instruments of the 21st century, for sure.
What got the country and the wider world excited about Hawaiian music? How did it even get to them?
Well, the Hawaiians were traveling to the big Pan American expositions and the world fairs. The one thing that I've been really amazed at is how much these guys were moving around. We think of the modern age of airplanes and modern technology as being more movement going on. But really, if you look back, these guys were taking steamships all over the world. Mekia Kealakai, who was the director of the Royal Hawaiian Band in 1920, had a career that started out when he was 15 playing trombone with the Royal Hawaiian Band. And he went to San Francisco with the band several times, quit the band and formed the Hawaiian National Band in support of the monarchy.
After the overthrow, right?
In 1895, traveled up the West Coast, and then kept traveling, traveled all through the Midwest, lived in Iowa, ended up in Paris and England. And the Martin Guitar Company is interested in his story because he was the very first guy to ever request that Martin make a full-size dreadnought guitar, which, as many people know, came to be the most imitated and widely popular the guitar that you're playing in the studio this morning.
I've got one sitting right here. It's the standard now.
Yeah, it is. And it has roots in Hawaiian music, which is a story that really needs to be told.
There are a lot of stories that you've uncovered that really hadn't been uncovered that really do deserve being told, just to help us understand not just music and stringed instrument playing, but Hawaiian culture.
Well, I'm a very humble student of this place and the people and the music, and I'm wowed constantly by what was happening here, and it's still happening here. But not many people know the tradition of mandolin music in Hawaii, but Ernest Ka'ai became really famous as an ukulele player, and he published the very first ukulele instruction manual in 1906. But before that, he was a mandolin teacher and virtuoso mandolin player that Johnny Almeida, who is oftentimes credited as being the greatest Hawaiian mandolin player, he said that Ernest Ka'ai was by far better than he was. And he had music schools, he had he had mandolin orchestras and quartets that were featured in Royal Hawaiian Band concerts in Honolulu in the late 1800s.
I've seen pictures of some of the mandolin orchestras that really caught on around the country.
It did, yeah.
In those years. I mean, there'd be 30 mandolins of different shapes and sizes.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And it's interesting, the ukulele got so popular. I think it kind of eclipsed a lot of the history of earlier instruments like the banjo, the fiddle. There's a whole fiddle tradition in Hawaii where I was talking to my good friend Kavika Kahiapo yesterday. He was saying when he tours the West Coast, he comes across Native American populations who always talk about the Hawaiians who came over way long time ago. And he was telling me there was a fiddle player who would play for hulas.
Well, of course, a mandolin is a fiddle in a different form. I mean, it's the same tuning,
same string
length.
Yeah, and this instrument that I've kind of put together takes the tuning of a mandolin, and it has an ukulele-shaped body and a tipple pin bridge, which is the tipple is another instrument that came out of Latin American culture. And the Martin Company built for many years. And Hawaiians picked it up and loved it because it had a kind of chimey mandolin sound, but was tuned like an ukulele. And So there's really nothing new anymore, I don't think.
Well, there may be, but we don't know what it is yet.
There's slight
right?
variations of things, but just when you think you've discovered something, you look back in history, and sure enough, someone's done it before.
Well, we're going to hear this new instrument at greater length in the second half of the show, but would you just pop a couple of chords to get an idea of what this thing can do? That chimey effect is because it's four what they call courses of strings, right?
Right.
Duplicated strings with tuned to exactly the same pitch.
Right.
But they never come out exact, do they? That's
well,
part
that's
of the
part
whole.
Of the charm of it is. Yeah. It's someone commented once, you spend half your life trying to tune these instruments and the other half playing out of tune.
Story of my life, Kylan.
But it is a magical kind of sound that you know, a lot of people. In slacky music, play 12-string instruments, and it has a very similar quality to it. You know, one thing that's been interesting I've been working on with the great Peter Rowan, who's a Nashville bluegrass singer-songwriter, played with Bill Monroe. We recorded actually last year an album of his original songs that are Hawaiian-themed with Jeff Aohoi and Doug Tolentino, and a handful of other musicians. And so it's kind of interesting that this research is happening. Martin wants to tell these stories. These instruments are coming back. And Nashville is turning its gaze back to the islands for inspiration and meaning. You know,
that's
Jimmy Rogers, who Peter Rowan is very inspired by, had a long history with Saul Ho'opi'i and other early steel guitar players.
That'd be a very welcome trend, Kylan. And we're going to hear more of your music in the second half of the show. But
awesome.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Kylan Reese is a guitarist and instrument builder whose new hybrid instrument is called the Tiple Inaleto, or perhaps the Mandola Leto. We're going to name it in the second half of the show. We'll be back in the second half to perform some holiday music.
Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Veronica Gale Worth of Honolulu, Suzanne Canavere of Kailua, and Pat Ka'ivi of Kihei for their recent membership gifts. Thanks to all of our listeners for your great support.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii, presenting the Honolulu Brass Quintet performing seasonal selections for Brass Ensemble, Monday, December 12th at Palikū Theater, chambermusichawaii.org.
Every year, 20,000 Hawaii employees file workers' compensation claims. Many who have been through the process say the system is broken, and now the state may be closer to agreeing with them. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we've heard from those who have filed workers' comp claims that delays and disputes over treatment are often,
yes,
you know, part of the very frustrating process. So what's the difference of how the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations is dealing with those complaints now?
Well, we'll see whether they follow through on the promises of a working group. That's what the legislature asked to set up, a working group, as well as an audit. State auditor is looking into this. And there are some things they've already identified. They want to be able to streamline the system. They want to modernize the paper-based processing of these claims. But others say, you know, that's just not aggressive enough. What you really have is a broken system. The problems are systemic, and you really need to reform the whole system from top to bottom. Whether that is going to happen or not remains to be seen. We did talk to Linda Chutakiyama, who runs the Labor Department here, and in addition to the audit, they are looking at collecting data, mm-hmm, to see what the data tells them about how the system is working, and those more systemic problems are something that she foresees dealing with down the road, but only after this audit comes through.
Yeah, streamlining is one thing, but a wholesale rebuild of a potentially broken system is quite another. that also doesn't exactly take into account the fact that this also comes down in some ways to how many doctors are willing to take workers' comp cases. What did you hear about that?
That is definitely one of the problems. And John Hill, our reporter, did talk to an expert in the field and saying only a tiny percentage of doctors here are willing to treat patients with workers' comp. And the reason is it's a big hassle. It's hard to get adequate payment. This is particularly pronounced on the neighbor islands, which, as you know, there's already a doctor shortage. There's not enough of incentive economically for many of them to relocate to the neighbor islands. So you have that compounding things as well. Then you have the fact that our workers' comp insurance carriers regularly deny compensation claims. They delay things. There has been no major reform, John found out, since 2002 with Hawaii's worker comp system. So clearly we're ripe for some change.
And at this point, we're going to have to wait and see what that change looks like only after they get this audit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And just by the way, if you read our story, John opens with a heartbreaking story of a woman who went through the hassles of workers' comp. It really puts a human face on this very tough struggle for so many. What'd you say? 20,000 people a year filing claims here in the state of Hawaii.
All right. Well, this one we will certainly be watching and talking about. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. In Hawaii news, you know that our state has a long-standing issue with its doctor shortage. For years, we've heard the state is hundreds short of doctors for a population of Hawaii's size. Add to that the fact that of the total 8,600 standard physician licenses granted, almost 48% of them are held by mainland or foreign docs. That's according to the Professional and Vocational Licensing Division's geographic report from last month. And it seems to make the point of Dr. Jim Barhall that while we may try to get more docs in Hawaii, telemedicine may, in fact, be undercutting that effort. It's ironic to hear him say that, as he is the co-founder of a practice that offers telemedicine, though he says all of his docs live in Hawaii. We talked recently for our special series, The Last Job in Hawaii.
Well, telemedicine was originally started for remote access, and I think very specifically for some emergency care, and then also radiology, which lends itself very well to sending images remotely for reads. So rural emergency room places where you wouldn't have a radiologist, or the ability to do certain things, it really helped open that up. So I think Hawaii in many ways is ideal because there are many underserved and remote areas in Hawaii. As far as bringing physicians to Hawaii, many of the physicians for telemedicine are actually mainland located. They're not actually in Hawaii, but are licensed in Hawaii. So I'm not sure it's really going to bring physicians into Hawaii, but it can certainly provide additional access for people who live in Hawaii.
Access to a physician when you need help can depend upon what kind of help you really need. How are they going to be able to determine whether or not they need to actually walk into a flesh and blood doctor who they're sitting in front of?
We have to understand that telemedicine in many ways has redefined what a doctor's office is and what a doctor's visit consists of. A doctor's visit is not necessarily defined as face-to-face now. So face-to-face or telemedicine visits are actually treated exactly the same as far as reimbursement from insurance companies. So really, you have to see this as a real revolution, and that it redefines what a doctor's office is and what a patient-doctor visit is in itself.
That seems to mean, though, that you also have to redefine what liability is, too.
Like anything else, certainly in what we do, which is urgent care, where we spend most of our time seeing people that we don't have a pre-existing relationship with, a lot of it comes down to your experience, your comfort zone, and your ability to understand when you're outside of an area as a physician where you can adequately diagnose and treat a patient. So certainly there are liability issues in telemedicine, and I think it requires very savvy physicians who are able to communicate well with patients and understand when something's not appropriate to be handled over a video screen as opposed to an in-person visit.
And be astute enough to actually say that and send them on. But in that loop of moving them to perhaps from that kind of telemedicine visit to going to the emergency room or any place else. What seems to be missing in that loop is a direct feed. So there's a link between what happens in a telemedicine visit and then what happens when that person gets to an emergency room, which could be solved by technology. Is there anything in the works that you know of that would streamline that for someone who has to go in to an emergency room visit?
We thought boots on the ground, quite frankly, was an important component to this whole system. We did see that as a gap. And knowledge of local physicians, local healthcare facilities, local pharmacies, local physical therapists, local pretty much anything you can think of. In addition to the obvious differences in Hawaii anyways, cultural differences, even language differences, phrases that are used, Hawaii is a little bit of a different place. So we thought that for a telemedicine point of view, there would be a gap between those situations which are not really appropriate for telemedicine and having, as they say in golf, local knowledge. So we think that that helps to smooth things out and make sure that people get the care they need when they need it and are directed to the appropriate facility for that particular situation.
So then back to the point of the fact that we've got a doctor shortage and that telemedicine was meant in some ways to be able to mitigate that. If, in fact, we have a whole complement of things that are, you know, you put in the bag of local knowledge for someone who is not a visitor who gets into trouble, but for somebody who lives and works here and doesn't have access to a doctor because there are enough doctors to go around, particularly in rural areas, it seems like they might be both served by telemedicine and not having a face-to-face doc, or that they're still going to have to be potentially coming to a different island or maybe even the mainland to get care.
I think there are a lot of cases that can be handled via telemedicine, a surprisingly large number of fairly routine situations. Certainly, there's going to be down the road, as the technology continues to improve, there's going to be a lot of chronic conditions that can be treated or monitored through telemedicine as more technology enters not only doctor's offices, but people will have these modalities in their home. Even right now, there's many things that can be done with telemedicine, virtual stethoscopes, virtual otoscopes, ophthalmoscopes, all kinds of monitoring. Telemedicine, which I said originally started to serve remote areas and even, you know, teleradiology, things like that, has really entered a direct-to-consumer type of phase. And so it's really pretty new, and I think all the permutations have still yet to be worked out.
As you look into the next 15 years, given all the experience that you've had and what you're currently doing, is telemedicine going to be replacing a number of doctors' jobs in Hawaii?
Of course, a lot of the healthcare as we move forward is going to be done by non-physicians, certainly mid-level providers and their
nurse practitioners,
and many of those are being produced. We work directly with pharmacies. We have something called a virtual healthcare center that we're working with Time Supermarket and KTA Superstores on the Big Island. We work directly with pharmacists for people to come into pharmacies, and pharmacists are already doing a lot more stuff than they used to do with flu shots, many kinds of injections. They can even run certain lab tests and therapeutic injections. So as we move forward, what we have really done with the pharmacies is create sort of a minute clinic without a provider physically being located there. So you take like a Long's drug where they have a nurse practitioner there. We are actually replacing that already in the pharmacies we work with a video screen or an iPad, and giving that pharmacist direct contact with our physicians working together as a team. So I think you're going to see more and more of that, and it may help reduce the need for more physicians.
In terms of replacement of jobs, do you see a threat from technology and telemedicine, but that a lot of people will, in fact, be supplanted by technology?
I think there's going to be disruption. I think whether it be an overall net loss, job loss, it's hard to say, but there's certainly people that will feel the effects, as they always do with these kind of technological disruptions. For example, the two main large players right now in telemedicine nationwide really advocating for national licensing. And I'm not talking about the companies now. I'm talking about the healthcare facilities, the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic. These are very well-known big brand names. And they're pushing for this because they want to be able to extend their brand nationwide and have their specialists provide consultation. And I'm sure there's many people in Hawaii that would be excited to be able to have a consultation with the Mayo Clinic physician. And I'm not suggesting they're any better than the Hawaii physicians, but those are big brand names. And so as this moves on, I see tremendous disruption where these large, big brand names, in much the same way that Amazon.com has taken out so many jobs, you know, bookstores and, you know, anything you can think of, that kind of technological disruption. So, yes, I think there's tremendous potential for job loss and a real change in the healthcare landscape because of telemedicine.
Dr. Jim Barhall co-founded DocNow this year to help give all Hawaii residents access to quality medical care, he says. Last month, DocNow partnered with KTA Superstores to launch a virtual clinic service in select KTA stores on Hawaii Island.
Good morning. I'm Aubrey Hawk from Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. According to the Hawaii 2015 Point in Time Count, our state has 7,620 homeless people. More than 1,300 of these are children who, through no fault of their own, are predisposed to psychological, physical, and emotional damage due to homeless episodes, and they're prone to a continuing cycle of homelessness. To help solve the crisis, 14 of our most concerned funders came together for a three-year, $4 million program called Housing ASAP. Their goal is to stably house 50% more families by reducing the time it takes to get these families into housing. If it's successful, Housing ASAP will increase the number of homeless families moving into permanent housing and reduce the amount of time they spend in the emergency shelters. Fortunately, there are donors trying to make a difference. This is one step to help relieve the homeless issue. It's clear, though, we need a lot more people on it to resolve the problem. So if you have a solution, please send it to me here at the station. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Mele, kaliki maka, and happy holidays. This is David DeLuca. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and there have been a lot of reasons to wonder how effective the plastic bag ban has been.
Well, and that's part of the conversation. What really is a one-time use? What's a reusable bag?
Yeah.
There's a lot of gray area in there, as we've seen, because we still see people being given plastic bags and being told to reuse them, but does that really make it a bag that's going to be compostable? And that seems to be the issue. And, you know, last week when we talked about what's happening on Maui with a ban, prevent those one-time use styrofoam containers from being used again, and supplanting them with others that might be compostable or would be compostable.
Well, we've certainly seen ample evidence of the damage that plastic bags and styrofoam containers do when they end up in the ocean, when they end up anywhere except where they're supposed to.
Which is the big push. So tonight we're going to talk about how effective that bag ban has been, looking forward to what Maui is trying to do and perhaps taking the lead in the state to do this. And we're going to be talking with Jennifer Milholland. She's the president of Styrophobia, which is a nonprofit now. And also Stuart Coleman will also be here from Surf Rider Foundation. And from Maui, we're going to talk with Rob Parsons, the environmental coordinator for the Maui's Office of Economic Development, and just see how this whole story is coming together as we move into the next year pretty quickly.
I love that name, Styrophobia. That kind of says what their mission is, doesn't it?
Well, there you go. Brilliant. Brilliant piece of marketing there.
Indeed. And everybody can call in, of course. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Remembering a slack key legend known as the Waimea Cowboy, who lived from 1932 to 1994 and was a major influence on every slack key artist to come along since. By the time the slack key revival began in earnest in the 1980s, when George Winston's Dancing Cat Records began its series of local recordings, he had become an elder statesman of the art form. He came from a large musical family. His aunts and his uncles all played slack key in the old school traditional way. And as he said of his uncle Kimo, he played a wicked guitar. He could play behind his back, behind his head, everything. Another relative, Harry Purdy Jr., a Paniolo on Hawaii Island's Parker Ranch, taught him songs about ranch life. Don Ho got his start playing with our mystery artists at Honey's in Kaneohe, and remember that he, quote, taught me everything I know about how to produce quality music. Today's young slack key artists celebrate the memory of Sonny Chillingworth, and that's our quiz answer for today.
Robert Dunn knew that. He called in from Kaimuki and will be receiving the HPR prize. It's now 8:49. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Also want to mention to you that earlier in the program we told you about a tsunami watch that was issued for Hawaii following a powerful earthquake off the Solomon Islands. That watch has now been canceled. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center canceled the watch and downgraded the strength of that earthquake to a still very strong 7.8 magnitude.
Holidays carry with them their own musical repertoire, one that invites endless interpretation. We met Kylan Reese and his new instrument in the first half of the show, and we've asked him to stick around to perform some holiday music with us. And Kylan, you know, there's any number of ways you can take these Christmas songs. Every year we sort of get out our Christmas fake books and rediscover them, don't we?
Oh, yeah. So many good songs.
Well, in this case, this is the Mandolinetto. Yes. Shall we settle on that name?
For now, I think that works pretty good.
Mandola being a plucked string instrument tuned like a viola, right?
Exactly. The whole mandolin family, just like the violin family, has mandolins and violins and violas and mandolas and mandocellos, like a cello, and even an octave mandolin, which I'm also making these days as well.
And this is a sort of a guitar or tiple body,
right,
with the string strung like a mandola.
Right, exactly.
Well, yeah. Let's have a little holiday music.
All right.
I'll count it off. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, I certainly hope everybody recognized that melody.
Got a little jazzy there, but you know.
Well, that's kind of what we do, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a nice blend to those instruments. This is the acoustic guitar, the dreadnought, as
right.
you described.
The Hawaiian dreadnought guitar. I think it's at this point fair to call it that, you know.
So I'm just going to play a G chord, and that's what it sounds like on a right. on a guitar. Why don't you pop one on that?
Yeah, and you know, the dreadnought guitar, like you were saying, these early Hawaiian guys were, they were at the forefront of not only string instrument design, but also the recording technology of the day.
Yeah.
And these guitar players were playing flat-top acoustic guitars for their steel guitar at that point. This is before the dobro and resonator guitars were, long before the electric steel was invented for sure. And they needed bigger and louder instruments, so that's why they kept asking these companies to make them good enough for the Hawaiians.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, don't we all? Let's play a little traveling music.
All right. Great to be here.
Carlin Reese joined us today on the Mandolinetto, a tiple mandolin mandola hybrid of his own invention. And you can see a video of him playing it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the science of handwriting.
We found in our studies that laptop note takers did significantly worse than students who took notes longhand.
And is the pro-handwriting movement the sinister position of big pencil and pen?
When you read studies about cursive, look to see who funds those.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, right after With Good Reason.
Hawaii needs docs.
Hawaii does need docs. And as we were talking about a little earlier this half hour with Dr. Jim Barhall, how it gets it may look a little different.
Yeah.
And as he says, cause a great deal of disruption.
But Hawaii, you know, geographically has a good place to start new innovations like the ones he talked about with, you know, using technology to move doctors into remote areas.
Or just bring patients to them via a screen, exactly, telemedicine. But if you missed any of our other episodes of The Last Job in Hawaii, you can always find them and this one with Dr. Jim Barhall on our website. Just look under The Conversation. It'll be there. That's going to do it for us for this day. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to take a look at what's happening with the ESSA in Hawaii, the Every Student Succeeds Act. Chairperson of the governor's ESSA team, Daryl Galera, will be here drawing together those takeaways from the series of meetings that have been happening over the last couple of months.
And we'll hear the music of the Gay Men's Chorus of Honolulu. If you want to get in touch with us, you can call us at our talkback line at 808-792-8217.
You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org and find past shows on our website. That's hawaiipublicradio.org, too. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation.
I'm Chris Van.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning with more of The Conversation. And I'll see you later for Town Square. See you then.